This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Just a quick note before we get started. It has been a while, hasn't it? We miss talking to you. We really do. We want you to say hello. So please talk to us on the Science Friday Vox Pop app, on Twitter, or even on that old-fashioned email. We'd love to hear from you, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Later in the hour, we'll talk about one bit of fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic, and that is that vaccine rates for children are going way down. But first, hydroxychloroquine, the malaria drug the president has been promoting as a treatment for COVID-19, has not only not been proven effective, but new research involving 96,000 patients around the world found heart problems and increased risk of death. The World Health Organization has paused a study of its own. Here with more is Amy Nordstrom, news editor for IEEE Spectrum. Welcome back, Amy.
Thank you, Ira.
Let's get into that story a little bit more. Tell us about this new research.
Yeah, so there's been controversy around using this drug, hydroxychloroquine, to treat COVID-19 patients. And as you say, it's still not been proven safe or effective for that purpose. So a number of trials are underway to see whether it might be. And last week, a study published in The Lancet reported more deaths than abnormal heartbeats among COVID-19 patients who took the drug. Now, this was an observational study. It wasn't a randomized control trial, which is kind of the gold standard in medicine. But it was quite a large observational study. And so other scientists are now trying to decide what those results mean for randomized control trials that are now enrolling patients and underway. So the World Health Organization said on Monday that it would temporarily suspend enrollment into its own randomized control trial for this drug. And it would be reviewing the data and making a decision soon about whether to proceed. Other scientists and trial organizers are taking different approaches. So there's another randomized control trial in Australia that was also paused for review. France's health ministry this week banned the use of the drug in treating COVID-19 patients. But a large trial called the Recovery Trial in the United Kingdom, actually the largest randomized control trial underway for this drug, those trial organizers have reviewed the study and have decided to proceed with their trial.
Is this the end of the use of the drug then, or are people still going to be using it, do you think?
Well, it's likely at least that some of these trials will continue, and typically it would be these randomized control trials that you'd want to see for definitive evidence, and you'd want to know that the drug is not only safe but also effective, and that's what these trials are trying to determine. And we're not there yet with this drug, and then even then, if that were proven to be the case, doctors would be evaluating against their own standard of care that they use in treating patients and also against other potential treatments that are being tested right now, which might turn out to be better.
Let's talk now about new insight into when coronavirus tests are most accurate, because this is something people want to know. Should I get tested? Can I trust the results of the test? Tell us about this new insight.
Yeah, testing is really important for tracking the spread of the virus. We know that, and to figure out who should quarantine themselves or contact people that they might have come into contact with. But the main tests that doctors use, called these RT-PCR tests, the kind that you get your nose swabbed for, aren't able to detect the virus with 100% accuracy. And a new meta-analysis from Johns Hopkins shows a high chance of false negatives with these tests. So that means being told you don't have the virus when you actually do, particularly early in a patient's infection. This is the first study to really measure the effectiveness of these tests during one patient's infection period over time. And they found a probability of getting a false negative went from 100% on the first day that you get the virus, meaning that these tests couldn't really detect it at that point because there was a very low viral load, to a low of about 20% a few days after someone starts showing symptoms.
So there's sort of an ideal window that the test needs to be done in.
Well, it's certainly more accurate, less likely to return a false negative a few days after you start having symptoms. So that's certainly the case. And physicians who are treating patients, the authors encourage them to not, you know, just evaluate these test results, but to also consider symptoms and recent contact with other infected people when they're evaluating a patient and recommending for them how to proceed.
On the plus side, though, there's some interesting engineering news. People are designing masks that kill the virus.
Yes, scientists at a few different universities are trying to figure out how to make masks that could deactivate the new coronavirus on contact. So I talked with Omar Farhat at Northwestern University. He's working on a design for a mask that would capture the coronavirus in a sponge-like structure on the front of the mask and then apply catalysts that cause the virus particles to break apart. And that's just one project. Scientists at Indiana University are focused on electroceutical fabrics that actually use tiny batteries to produce weak electric fields that can disrupt the electrostatic forces that hold the virus together. And neither of these have been tested on the new coronavirus yet, but the teams are hoping to develop technology that could also work on other viruses, including possibly the seasonal flu.
I imagine these things are done on a test bed, and they're just little models that would have to be redesigned for mass manufacturing.
Yeah, it's pretty early. They've gotten some research funding to kind of prove this concept. They would still need to show that it works against viruses, including the new coronavirus. And they would need to partner with the manufacturer and make sure that this technique could be incorporated into the manufacturing process for masks and at a cost that, you know, would make sense for, example, healthcare facilities that have to buy a lot of these.
Okay, let's move on a little to other research, because there is science going on out there, isn't there? Other stuff we can report on.
Absolutely.
I know you covered a cool new data storage project this week, something I love to talk about, material science, storing information in glass. Tell us about that.
That's right. You know, the world is always generating more data, and we need new places to put it. And one option for long-term storage is an experimental technology that's being developed at Microsoft through an effort known as Project Silica. Researchers at Microsoft are using lasers to store data in small glass squares. So rather than writing on like the surface of a DVD or a CD, they actually write in many layers inside of the glass itself. And they've shown that this approach can pack a lot more data in, and they think it can last for much longer.
And so how much data are we talking about here?
Well, in a disk about the size of a DVD, they could put 360 terabytes of data, they think, and compare that to the most a DVD could store today would be about 1 terabyte.
Wow. And it would last a lot longer than the stuff we have now, the DVDs and maybe the thumb drives?
Yeah, they did a bunch of tests of these squares. They exposed it to high heat and even flooded it with water and tried to influence them with magnetic fields. And it didn't destroy the data. And they believe that the data could last in these small glass squares for possibly centuries. So they're actually working on creating what they call a Rosetta Stone for glass so that people far into the future would know how to access and read this data back.
Yeah, because that's always the problem. You know, we see that in science fiction movies. They've discovered something and miraculously know how to read it, but that's not how it would work in real life.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they would need to communicate to future users of this data storage technology what it is and how to access data written to it.
I love this idea because I'm also worried that it's glass, right? It's fragile. You drop your glass cell phone and it cracks and goes away.
Yeah, I know. It seems like an interesting material to use, but they use a very pure form of glass. It's actually the same kind of material that's found on the windows of the International Space Station. So, you know, we've trusted it with important jobs before.
I can see data being written on the windows. No, that's a different story. Let's go on to a new story about behind this sound I'm going to play right now. What is that noise, Amy?
Well, you've just heard one kind of sound that a narwhal makes. So narwhals are a type of whale with a big tusk on the front of their face. They live far north in Arctic waters, and they're known for being pretty shy and skittish. So it's tough to monitor and track them. So researchers from Japan recently took a creative approach. They actually joined a local hunting expedition in Greenland, and they used underwater microphones to record sounds that narwhals make, including that clip that you've just heard.
Wow, that was interesting because I know narwhals are pretty mysterious creatures. How did the researchers get these sounds?
Well, they used a technology that's fairly typical for these kinds of projects. It's kind of an underwater microphone, and they were able to go out with local hunters that use kayaks and motorboats to track these narwhals, and then the hunters helped them locate the narwhals and find them on the horizon in the water. And then they were able to get close enough to capture some of these audio clips.
I imagine, as always, this could help conserve narwhals, keep them from dying out.
Yeah, it's not totally clear, you know, where these populations of narwhals live or where they move and why and when. And so they're hoping that knowing what they sound like and figuring out what sounds they use for different purposes would help scientists monitor these populations, which are threatened by things like climate change because they rely on the sea ice. They spend part of their winter under the sea ice. And so as it retreats, they're affected.
Mm-hmm. Let's also talk lastly about mysterious moss balls on glaciers. Moss balls? Say that right. 10 times fast.
Yeah, it's a tricky tongue twister. So glaciologists for decades have found balls of moss. So the moss like you'd find on the forest floor, wrapped up into balls about the size of your hand, on glaciers in Iceland and Alaska. And they've noticed that these moss balls tend to move around. Now researchers published recently in the journal Polar Biology tracked the movement of these balls over time, and they found that these balls, groups of these balls, actually move in a coordinated fashion. So they move together at roughly the same speed in the same direction, and all change direction at about the same time. And scientists really don't know why. The movements of these balls don't seem to correlate with things like the direction of the wind or where the sun's shining, and the balls don't always roll downhill. So this is an open question, and they're still trying to come up with a theory for why these moss balls are behaving in this way.
Are they just rolling around on the ice like, you know, tennis balls? How fast are they moving? How do they move?
Well, they're not moving that fast. I think it was about 2.5 centimeters a year. So it's a slow crawl, I would say. But yeah, and they're quite dense. In these balls, you can find often several kinds of moss and even small critters like the tardigrades. That we know and love. So they're little ecosystems of their own.
That's really fascinating. I want to thank you for enlightening us with some lighter, more fun news this week that we can all use, I think.
Yeah, sure thing.
Amy Nordrum is news editor at the IEEE Spectrum based in New York City.